Hello, and welcome to the Tennis Worthy Podcast, brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. I'm Patrick McEnroe, the president of the Hall of Fame. In recent years, February has become established as Black History Month, and to honor that, we're presenting two podcasts this month, which focus on the struggle African-American men and women have had in getting recognized in tennis, including being simply banned from competing against the best because of the color of their skin.
We're a product of our parents a lot of times in our situations and, you know, where we live. And so good can be passed down just like bad can be passed down.
They knew what it meant to be folks who were not insiders in what was then definitely the elite game of tennis.
If a Black person won a tennis tournament over white people, then, and this is just clear, it's horrible, but it's in there very clearly, then it would be, oh no, then Black people might think they were as good as whites.
He knew this was it. If he was going to be Wimbledon champion, he had to win that day. And he started to play totally contrary to everything he'd ever done on a tennis court before.
There's many African-American players, male players, who's come up the ranks, but they haven't really taken the trophy in the way that he has. And so some of these issues still prevail and still exist, and we still have to keep the fight going.
As far as you can go with Ora Washington, just how good would she have been?
I think if she had had the opportunity and the support and the training, I think she'd have been the best.
In this first podcast, we're focusing on the first person of color to win her major title, Althea Gibson. And before Gibson, a player who simply wasn't allowed to compete with the best in the world because of her racial heritage. Chris Bowers guides us through both stories.
There's a fascinating fact about Althea Gibson that many people overlook. It's widely known within tennis that she was the first Black Grand Slam champion, but few are aware that she was the first Black player allowed to compete in a major tournament. Think about that. The first person to break a barrier is very seldom the person who goes on to the next step. They normally pave the way for others, but Gibson did both. Despite excelling in her teens as a player in the non-white American Tennis Association tournaments, she wasn't allowed to compete in the US Nationals, the forerunner of today's US Open, until 1950, when she was 23. And even that came after a concerted campaign, fought by the former champion Alice Marble and others, to enable Gibson to compete at Forest Hills in 1950. I spoke to Gibson's biographer, Ashley Brown, about Gibson's impact, and started by asking how influential Althea Gibson was.
I think she was greatly influential in the sense that so many people saw Gibson play tennis in America, but also around the world. So in the 1950s, between 1955 and 1959, she made a number of tours for the U.S. State Department. And that meant that people in a variety of countries saw Gibson play, and they saw a Black American play the game of tennis. But a number of those folks were people of color who perhaps saw a little bit of themselves in Gibson. And they saw that maybe tennis is not a sport that perhaps was associated with them, with their backgrounds, but this could be a fun and exciting thing for them to do and to take on. So I think that's important. And then back to the many African Americans who saw her play. In the United States, among middle and upper class African Americans, there was something of a growing tradition of tennis, thanks to the American Tennis Association, which had been her sponsor for a number of years. And so a number of African Americans had already been exposed to the game of tennis, but the game only grew in popularity among those folks after seeing Gibson and hearing more of her story. And that's important because think of all the just especially among women in America, African-American women, think of the great Black female champions that the United States has produced. Now, obviously, we think about the Williams sisters, but even before them, think of Katrina Adams and Leslie Allen. Think about Zena Garrison. Look at where we are in terms of Sloane Stephens and Coco Gauff. It means a great deal when people can see someone who shares something with them in terms of their background, their story. That inspires people to believe that maybe I can do this. The challenges, the difficulties, maybe I can face those and overcome them because I've seen someone who looks like me. And I think for generations of Black women in tennis, Gibson, beginning in the late 1940s, early 1950s, she became that person.
there was a massive battle to get her into the US National Championships at Forest Hills in 1950. Was that something that all black athletes aspired to, or was there a counter-movement whereby black athletes were saying, no, 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 let the whites come to us. Why should we have to join their circus?
Well, we have to think about the moment. So in 1947, of course, Jackie Robinson became the first black man to play in Major League Baseball since the turn of the 20th century. This is also just a few years after the National Football League put out its, or ended, I should say, its rather unwritten ban on having black players that had been instituted around 1932, 1933. And also in 1950, the National Basketball Association had its first four black players. And so we have to think about the particular moment in terms of context of integration. But yes, there were certainly African Americans, some of whom in the middle 1940s were in the American Tennis Association, who wanted to see faster and quicker actions. You know, they were supportive to a degree of the integrated exhibition matches that the American Tennis Association had put in place or had been leading since about 1940. But they also thought, you know what, this has been going on for a number of years where it's always the American Tennis Association working primarily with professional white tennis players who put these together. Their thinking was the exhibitions are enough. We need greater action. It's time for the American Tennis Association, but really more so the United States Lawn Tennis Association, to do more to tear away the color line.
Did Gibson take a few years to get used to being in a white environment? We think of the peak of her career, 56, 57, 58, and yet her first time at Forest Hills was 50.
I think I'm much more comfortable saying that it took her a while to develop into the champion that she became. So Angela Buxton, who was a dear friend of hers, really from the middle 1950s until the end of Gibson's life, she told me in an interview that the tours that Gibson made with the State Department beginning in 1955, 56, that those were really important to making her become, certainly this was amateur tennis, but official, particularly more, we might say, professionalized as a player. That was where she developed an even greater sense of discipline, a greater sense of scheduling, a greater sense of learning what she needed to do to take care of her body, but also in terms of travel arrangements so that she could be the best player that she became.
And was she ahead of the pack at that stage? When were the top white players doing the same kind of things, or was she actually setting new standards?
That is an excellent question. I think she actually, and this is what happens with integration, right? People from all different backgrounds and places, they come together, they see each other, they learn from each other. I think this was an opportunity for her to learn from the new people who were with her. Dr. Eaton, who was her great mentor, who lived in Wilmington, North Carolina, he told her early on that when she went to various tournaments, it wasn't enough for her simply to play her own matches, but she needed to make sure that she attended several matches as a spectator. And she could do two things as a spectator. First of all, she could get a sense of her competition, so size up the players that she would inevitably play, whether it would be at that tournament or at another tournament. But she could also learn from their games, learn from their strokes, get a sense of what she could do, what she could maybe build into her own game to become a better player. And there were some people in the press who criticized her for this. They thought that she was getting too much into experimentation. But she always contended that no, that she needed to observe and learn so that she could become a better player. And she did.
You mentioned Angela Buxton. The two of them, Gibson and Buxton, won Wimbledon women's doubles in 1956. Buxton faced her own prejudice as a Jew in London. To what extent did it lift Gibson, the fact that her doubles partner was somebody who'd faced many of the similar issues that she faced herself?
Well, I interviewed Angela Buxton in the course of writing my book, and she said something, I'll try to get the quote or the words right, but she said that when she met Althea Gibson, she took her as she saw her, and she liked what she saw, and basically they just moved forward from there. They were terrific friends for something like a half century. And I think it bonded them, that both of them knew what it meant to be on the outside looking in. They knew what it meant to be folks who were not insiders in what was then definitely the elite game of tennis. And so there was a sense of understanding, I think, that Angela Buxton brought to Althea Gibson, so that when Gibson expressed ambivalence about what it meant to be a racial trailblazer in the 1950s, Buxton, in pieces that she wrote as forms of journalism in British tennis magazines, she didn't judge Gibson for this. She simply saw it as her friend's struggle, her friend as having this hurdle that she had to overcome with regard to race and identity that the vast majority of other people in tennis did not face.
To what extent did Althea Gibson want to be an icon for African-American women, or did she take the Arthur Ashe approach and say, I just have to be beyond reproach?
I think just in terms of chronology and generations, it might have been Ashe taking the Althea Gibson approach. And I also think that she didn't set out to be a symbol, a heroine for folks. I think, understandably, she knew that if she succeeded, then ideally that would mean, could mean something of significance and importance to the many people, folks of color, African Americans who were watching her. And so it caused a great deal of tension between Gibson and her mentors, between Gibson and the African American press. But her foremost priority was to be the top tier competitive athlete that she burned to be. She wanted to win. And I think after that, everything else could take care of itself.
Yes, you make a valid point on the chronology. I suppose I should have said the Robert Johnson approach, because he influenced both of them.
Exactly.
Was actually Johnson mentoring Gibson during her peak years in the second half of the 50s?
To a degree, there was a misunderstanding among some people in the African-American media that Gibson had, to quote one journalist, there's a headline that asked whether Althea Gibson had gone, quote, hi-hat. And some people were accusing her of turning her back on the American Tennis Association, but also turning her back on her mentors, Dr. Eaton and Dr. Johnson. And in my archival research, I actually found that it wasn't true, this rumor, spurious rumor that she had abandoned them. She was greatly influenced by those two men. She thought the world of them. She dedicated her first book to them. Specifically, the phrase was, to my two doctors. And as she traveled around the world, she regularly sent letters and postcards to Dr. Eaton and, I suppose, to Dr. Johnson. When she was at sea about her future and the transition between amateur tennis and professional tennis, she actually reached out to both men, and she spent some time with Dr. Johnson just seeking his counsel, seeking his wisdom. So those were definitely two men who greatly influenced her thoughts and her thinking. And I think there were certainly frustrations in their relationships, as there can be in all relationships between mentors and protégés. But I think there was also a great deal of love and affection there.
We look back on Venus and Serena Williams and look at the impact that they had. Althea Gibson obviously had less impact, but was that just a product of the time? Or was it that she was a less outgoing personality than Venus and Serena were encouraged to be?
I think there were a few things at work. First of all, tennis wasn't her only sport. So we have to remember she was a multi-sport athlete and went on to set her sights on tennis. And in 1963, 1964, became the first African-American woman to compete on the LPGA Tour. So as someone who loves the game of golf, I like to point that out. I think it also, in terms of legacy and pace of legacy and influence, we also have to think about that moment in time. So tennis was really at the top of the pedestal when it came to, or the top of the totem pole, we might say, when it came to what were regarded as acceptable sports for women. So she was playing that particular game, but remember, she's playing it in the 1950s. This is decades before Title IX. She's also playing in a moment in which tennis and the focus on women in sport, it's very, very different from what we saw in the 1970s with the tennis boom. And if I were to politely make a criticism of tennis, it would be that it seems that historically so much of the focus really became the 1970s and after, that somehow we became, I think, rather short-sighted. And so it's Gibson, but also a number of leading tennis players in the 1940s and 50s and 60s. And even you could go back to the 20s and 30s, they've rather been forgotten because so much of the emphasis was placed on the glitz and glamour and, let's face it, the money that entered tennis starting in the 1970s. And this is why we have, you know, so much attention, and they deserve it, to people like Everett and Navratilova and Arthur Ashe too, McEnroe and Connors and the like. But this has also meant that perhaps we've put something of a shade, a shadow over the champions and the life stories of players who were playing during Gibson's generation.
Which brings me to the question of the title of her autobiography, I Always Wanted to Be Somebody. We're talking about her. So she clearly was somebody fairly major in not just tennis, but in the sporting world and societally as well. But did she doubt whether she was somebody?
Oh, I don't think she ever doubted her abilities. She was known for having great self-confidence. But I think many of us would agree that perhaps we've all known people who come across as having a lot of self-confidence, and sometimes that actually masks uncertainty and great vulnerability. And she was certainly vulnerable at the end of her life as well as at other periods. But I Always Wanted to Be Somebody. It comes from, the phrase itself comes from this poem that an African-American minister, Reverend Borders, had written. And he took this idea of somebodies in African-American history and used this as an idea to tout the legacies of a number of people, not always athletes, who were African Americans and who, in his view, had excelled and achieved great things despite segregation and discrimination. And so with that title, I Always Wanted to Be Somebody, I definitely see the title as Gibson's way of adding her name to that list of African Americans in a number of fields who had done things that were perhaps not expected of them, because of stereotypes and pejorative ideas of African Americans at that time. I think the title suggests that she saw herself as an important and leading figure, and she was signaling that to other people who might read her book, but also people who might have doubted that she'd accomplished the great things that she did.
Ashley Brown, the author of Serving Herself, The Life and Times of Althea Gibson, the first full-length biography of Gibson, talking to me about the influence and impact of this remarkable woman. In that interview, Ashley Brown uses the term Title IX. That refers to the American civil rights law, which prohibits sex discrimination in education, a move that made a significant contribution to women getting scholarships in the American college system. Title IX was only passed in 1972, so a good 25 years after it would have helped Gibson. And Brown also highlighted that tennis before the Open era has been given less attention than she feels it deserves, that the tennis of the 50s and 60s has been put somewhat in the shade, indeed the tennis of the 20s and 30s too. Which brings us neatly onto Ora Washington, a somewhat forgotten player from the interwar years who's only now being properly known and appreciated. Born around 1898 in rural Virginia, she was 8 times national champion in singles and 15 times in doubles, 11 of those in succession, but only on the segregated American Tennis Association circuit, which was for blacks only. Pamela Grundy from the University of North Carolina is currently working on the first biography of Ora Washington. I started by asking Grundy how good a player Washington would have been.
Well, you just can't know, because she wasn't allowed to play outside the black community. The other question would be, how good would she have been had she gotten the support and the coaching, and if she hadn't had to work as a housekeeper all her life in order to survive? So what she did was against very great odds anyway. But I also see in her and in the comments about her, she was an incredible athlete, a credible natural athlete. She was determined. She was brilliant strategy-wise. So I would say, had she had the opportunity and perhaps with some of the support, there's no question she would have made quite the splash at Wimbledon.
How was she actually taught? How did she pick up tennis? Was she in fact taught?
She started in her 20s at the Germantown YWCA. She was in Philadelphia. Everybody from rural Virginia. She grew up in rural Virginia. There was no future in rural Virginia. So young people all migrated to the city of Philadelphia, which was relatively close. And there were lots of African-Americans who just come from the South doing various things. And there were a couple of black YWCAs, YMCAs, YWCAs. Again, there's segregation, not as much as in the North, but you have separate organizations. The Germantown YWCA was really very much for domestic workers to bring them in. They had educational classes. They had cultural lectures and they had athletics. And for some reason, they had tennis courts.
So when are we talking about? If she's in her early 20s, we'd be talking about, what, the second decade of the 20th century?
Yeah, this would have been probably right around 1920 that she comes in. She apparently picks up a racket. Now, there's a story. There's lots of stories, and it's hard to know which are really true. She did have a sister pass away right around the time she started playing. And one story says that she was just so disconsolate over her sister's death that someone said, well, why don't you try tennis? It'll be a distraction. And then, of course, I'm sure because, again, she was this fabulous athlete, the second she picked up a racket, people knew, well, this is someone special. And so I don't know if she had coaches, but there were people who played tennis. There were a good group of people who played tennis. So I'm sure she got some help at the beginning. And there was a great coach in Chicago, a great woman. And this is terrible that I don't remember her name. But there was one point at which Aura went and spent about a year in Chicago. And I guess, even though there's not evidence, that she went to work with this terrific coach. And it is, in fact, the year after she goes that she breaks through and wins the singles title. Before, she'd been winning doubles, getting close in singles, but not breaking through.
Because one assumes that all the top players play, to a certain extent, technically correct tennis. But I'm assuming she was just self-taught and probably would have looked like the kind of player you see in most tennis clubs, who's just taught themselves but can play a really good game.
Well, I think she had an unusual grip, apparently, and she had something of an unusual style. Again, yes, she's obviously she wasn't trained up. She didn't have coaches at 8 like they were talking about earlier. I mean, she had not trained from a young age. And I think the fact that she had this extraordinary athletic ability, you know, you can get away with things if you're not, you know, if you're great. So I think it was somewhat unorthodox, but I don't know how many people, and I'm writing a biography of her. Talk to me in a couple of years. I'll probably know the answers to all of this. I would expect that a number of people had unusual styles. Now, Aura was unusual. Most of the black tennis players of the time came from clubs and came from professional backgrounds, like with other tennis. It was an elite sport. Aura was from the country. She was working class. Again, she worked as a domestic, as a housekeeper all her life. So probably some of the other players had started younger, had the benefit of better courts and more teaching and such. So they may have been more technically conventional. But that's, again, just surmising on my part. I'll say this. I came to Aura through basketball. I have done a lot of work. I've written a book on the history of women's basketball, and she was an extraordinary basketball player as well. She was the best female basketball player in the country. She was really the first black female athletic star in the United States. Now, star in the black community, people in the white community had no idea who she was. I mean, there was such a divide under segregation that, you know, you just didn't – black people knew what white people were doing because that was very obvious. White people didn't know black people.
I was going to ask you, I mean, if she'd had a chance to play against a white person, what would the repercussions have been?
It's very interesting. It's a little complicated. Sometimes in basketball, they played against white teams.
And in boxing, it was almost like a freak show to have a white guy against a black guy.
Well, it was, I wouldn't call it a freak show. It was very profitable because there was this added layer. The more organized sports like baseball, like tennis, tended to have these very specific, you know, the barriers were very high. So Major League Baseball draws the color line and that is it, till Jackie Robinson. Tennis, very organized, draws the line itself and it's it, till Althea Gibson. But something like boxing is much less organized. It's run by these promoters who, if they can get a match arranged and they can get the right people. And again, if you have a black fighter and a white fighter, oh, you've got a match, you know, you've got something people will pay money to see.
So obviously the line was drawn in tennis, but nobody crossed it, because if it's attractive to have a white fighter against a black fighter in boxing, why is it not attractive to have a white person against a black person in tennis? Not that it should matter, but why was the line adhered to?
Well, I think tennis was an elite sport, and they weren't trying to get as many paying customers as they could find. We're talking just at center court. They're like, well, we have no advertisement at center court. They don't like it, and they don't need the money. So I think, and in fact, having anything like money or spectators or promotion would have gone against the sort of elite values of the time. They were supposed to be, I think, at least in the U.S., a little above it all. You know, you wouldn't like stoop to try to get people to come and see your matches.
Okay, so was there within the black tennis community also a hierarchy based on social snobbery? Were there certain people who said, I play tennis, I am socially higher than those who don't?
Absolutely. I mean, there is a black elite. They are very, concerned about maintaining a position, particularly since, you know, for all African Americans, life is always marginal. I mean, there's, you know, white supremacy. Anything can happen to anyone at any time. You know, there's sort of stories in the South of soldiers who had come back from World War I, World War II. They'd be on the street in their uniforms and they could get attacked. You know, here they were, you know, it didn't matter who you were. So there was, you know, people were very concerned to keep that up. And it was also cultural. The challenge that Ora faced, again, from the country, working class woman, seems never have to made the effort to move into, you know, like some like Babe Diedrichson sort of glams up and does some things to try to move into, to fit into those social circles. Ora seems not to have done that. And so she was kind of looked down upon, I think. You get the sense that the leaders of the sport were not that excited that their greatest player was a working class woman and a lesbian.
So she was a social outcast within the black tennis community?
Yes. Yes, because there was a lot of hierarchy within black communities. There were places where that broke down a little more than in white communities. For example, if you were a very fine guard, you know, worked on people's gardens, or a elevator operator in a hotel, you had a social status in the black community that was higher than you would have in the white community, because you had a steady job and, you know, you could maybe afford to buy a house. And as long as you conducted yourself in an entirely respectable manner, conventionally respectable, then you probably got more credit in the black community than you would have in a white community. But there's very strict lines and a very strict concern about what's respectable, about behaving properly, because, you know, there's this whole stigma, you know, through white supremacy, that white supremacy is needed because African Americans don't have self-control, don't know what's right. I mean, you know, these terrible stereotypes. So it's very important to particularly the middle upper class African Americans that people behave in ways that contradict those stereotypes. And I don't think I actually don't know, because you don't know these things. All you can do is read the newspapers, and that tells you.
And your source material is obviously incomplete.
It's incomplete. And, you know, and with tennis or with sports, you know, sports journalism can be very frustrating because they don't really delve into things as much as you'd like. So you get the matches and you might have a quote here and there, but you don't have that much stuff. I mean, I don't think Ora went out and like broke rules and like drank too much and smashed, you know, anything like that. But she still wasn't the, you know, prim and proper, well-dressed, flirtatious woman, you know, or very clearly, you know, heterosexual woman that fit what was respectable at the time. Althea Gibson runs into this too. Well, when she starts to play, and the black community is, if anything, more concerned that she act properly than the white community.
It's interesting. You mentioned Althea Gibson. I mean, Ora Washington's peak period was late 20s, early 30s. Althea Gibson's peak period was late 50s. But in the late 40s, she had advocates. She had the likes of Alice Marble, who was willing to write a very powerful editorial in a tennis magazine. She had people like Sarah Palfrey and Mary Hardwick. Was nobody actually speaking up for Ora Washington, or had American society changed so much by the late 40s that actually it was not safe for anyone to speak up for Ora Washington?
Well, something happened in the early 40s that had a big impact sort of worldwide. And I think after World War II, that was really a period in the U.S. when things started to break down. Of course, you had the, we had what's called the Double V campaign for African Americans, victory over racism abroad, victory over racism at home. There had been concerns about how committed black soldiers and such would be to a country that saw them as second-class citizens. There wasn't a problem, but there was a very significant effort to do that. So it's really right after the war that people have been making efforts all along. But that's really when there was a moment that there was something open and people could advocate and make change. Back when Ora was playing, it was the Depression. People were trying to make a living. There was some, you know, stuff here and there. Eleanor Roosevelt was very, open-minded in terms of race. But there wasn't the kind of possibility for really breaking through and making a change. What you could get, which is what happens during that era, is that within black communities, they build up in all sorts of areas, you know, sports, professions and these things, so that when the opening comes, they're ready. You know, when history shifts, you know, the door opens, you're ready to step right through it. So that was a period where there was a building, which meant that there were mentors for Althea when she was ready to, you know, smooth off the rough edges, which Ora never got, to help, you know, train her, to really give her the kind of training that she needed. But that was the roots of that are all back in those institutions. Started 1916 is when the American Tennis Association is formed for black people, because the American Lawn Tennis, the U.S. Lawn Tennis Association, won't let blacks into their tournaments.
Regardless of how good they are.
Regardless. That was the light. In fact, being good might have been more of a problem, because then you might win. And if a black person won a tennis tournament over white people, then, and this is just clear, it's horrible, but it's in there very clearly, then it would be, oh no, then black people might think they were as good as whites, and then they might want more, and this would be very bad. And so that's what sports was very important symbolically for that reason.
So a little sideline here. In some countries, tennis is known as the white sport, not because of race, but because of the colour that people wore up until about 1968, 1970. Did the black tennis community always dress in white?
Yes, of course, because, again, you're looking at this respectability issue, and they dressed in the cleanest, best ironed, whitest outfits possible, because that was how you demonstrated that you were respectable, that you were worthy, in a sense, of better treatment than you were getting. It was a difficult strategy. There were some problems. I mean, there were some people in the black community who did not feel that this was the best strategy, because it sort of depended on white people then recognizing you as being, you know, worthy, which was not necessarily very promising. So absolutely, you know, in different aspects of, you know, black life, obviously you have color and you have music and it's all that, but absolutely not in tennis.
Is there any evidence that Ora Washington would like to have played against the top white players of the day?
No. There is a story that is undocumented, you know, it sort of floats around, that she had really wanted to play Helen Wills, but that Helen Wills had said no. Now, that part's not true. You know, I don't think Helen Wills ever knew Ora Washington existed. You know, that was, she just, the worlds were so separate. I am sure that Ora would have liked to play some of the top players. Again, she knew she was very good. She had not a lot of competition among the best black players. I just can't imagine that she wouldn't have. And she would have known who they were, because people in black communities knew what was going on in white communities, because there was a lot more publicity and, you know, they kind of had to pay more attention. But there was absolutely no path where she could possibly have done that.
Okay, so the ultimate question here is, we love to compare eras. We love to say, would Tilden at his peak have beaten Laver at his peak? Would Laver have beaten Federer or Djokovic? Would Longlen have beaten Navratilova, both at their peaks? Now, you can't tell because they didn't play in the same era, and tennis was very different anyway. As far as you can go with Ora Washington, just how good would she have been?
I think if she had had the opportunity and the support and the training, I think she'd have been the best. I really do, because you see how much she made of what little she had. And if she had had more to work with, she would have been amazing.
Now, we're focusing on Ora Washington, but how do we know there weren't others, either other women who were ATA champions in a different era, post-1916, obviously, or men's ATA champions? Why the focus on Washington? Was she just the best in the segregated era?
Washington was definitely the most dominant. She won the most straight titles. She was universally acknowledged as by far the best in the women's. The men's, it's back and forth. You don't have a man who emerges as the dominant man. There's a couple of other great players, Lulu Ballard, who she defeats several times, who's her doubles partner, and they won 20 titles as doubles partners. So there are some good players, but she definitely stands, I would say, above the others. The other thing, frankly, it's history. I got interested in Ora Washington, and now there's a lot about Ora in lots of places because we actually access the material. And once you tell that story, then everybody, you know, the BBC did it. Lots of people want to tell the story. So,
okay, so what should tennis do to give Ora Washington the recognition that she deserves?
Well, she should certainly be in all the halls of fame. I think she's in a couple, but I'm not sure she's in all of them. And I think acknowledgement in museums and, you know, whenever the history of tennis is done, everybody needs to know who she was. Everybody needs to appreciate what she did. I think Ora absolutely should be there in a way that acknowledges and to some degree explains how amazing she was and what she had to do to be that good and just to make her way in the world.
She also stands for a world that an awful lot of people alive today cannot imagine ever existed. The idea that she was not allowed to play against somebody of her own gender, same age, just because of the color of her skin.
So, okay, here I'm talking, I'm giving a talk. I'm here in the UK, and I start talking about segregation. And I think the thing that I realize is that many people outside the US, and many people in the US too, do not understand how hard that line was, how completely and how comprehensive it was. And it was for very good reason. White supremacists who ran most things in the US were wanting to label African Americans as inferior. Like across the board, just flat inferior. And so every little piece of life, the white and colored fountains, the separate waiting rooms, the refusal to allow interracial sports competition was all part of creating this bubble, in a sense, I'll say it, hegemonic, just this comprehensive, you would go through your life, particularly as a white person, and just never imagine that a black person was as good as you, because there was nothing in your life that told you any different. And I think it's very hard when you're not in that to comprehend how comprehensive it was, how complete and how hard those lines were, and how separated in so many ways. Now, of course, black people are going to work in white homes and white yards, and I mean, there's this level of contact. But back in the communities, you know, back in, you know, when you go home to live, they're segregated, and it's a completely different world. That's why I say I don't think Helen Wills ever had an idea that Ora Washington existed, that there was this great other player, you know. And I think one of the things that happened with this that I think is very interesting, there were all sorts of sporting institutions built up. The Negro Leagues are the most famous. Some great basketball players, college programs. People say, well, how did Ora get forgotten? You know, well, she was this amazing. Why don't we know? And what happened was when desegregation came, all attention, white and black, well, whites paid attention for the first time, and then black communities focused on the pioneers, the Jackie Robinsons, the Althea Gibsons, and this segregated era pretty much got forgotten or was not looked at even within black communities for quite a while. It's not until the 1970s that historians start to say, hey, particularly with the Negro Leagues, hey, they were great players in the Negro Leagues. That's an interesting experience. You know, we've got to learn more about that. And you get this very thriving culture. The problem with Aura was that she died in 1971. So she passes away before there's this interest in going back. And she's in total obscurity. I mean, when she finished playing, she went back in basically her family, her work in white people's homes, and that was it. She didn't stay connected, partly because she wasn't of the same social class. In 1976, there's a newly formed Black Tennis Hall of Fame by black people, you know, black leaders, and they put Aura in her first, in their first class in 1976, and they don't know she's dead. They don't know anything about her. They were hoping she would somehow find out they were giving this award and show up. And there's a chair when they're doing the presentation for her just in case she comes. And, of course, she didn't. And so that's just to, you know, to how things slip away. If they're not seen as important in the present, you know, what was important during desegregation was that people were breaking barriers. They were moving. It was not like, oh, and before that, they did all these things. And so that slips away. And one of the things that I think is wonderful about the rise of black female tennis players today is that then people are saying, oh, what's the history of that? We need to go back and, you know, if it's important today, there must be important roots. And so that has, I think, brought a very welcome new interest in the history of black women in tennis.
Pamela Grundy and her book on Aura Washington will be fascinating when she publishes it in a couple of years. Just in case you're wondering whether Aura Washington and Althea Gibson ever met, well, we know they did. They were on opposite sides of the net in the mixed doubles final at the American Tennis Association Championships of 1947, held in Alabama. The International Tennis Hall of Fame even has a photo of the four finalists in its archive. Washington partnering George Stewart, who was to emulate Gibson's feat by becoming the first man to be allowed to compete at Forest Hills. Gibson partnered by her and Arthur Ashe's mentor, Robert Johnson. The photo shows Washington wearing glasses and long trousers, dark trousers at that, standing next but one to her female opponent, who was almost 30 years younger. The match was apparently a cliffhanger, Stewart and Washington winning in three sets. In all photos of her, Washington looks resigned more than angry, and many have talked about a sadness she always seemed to emit. Perhaps that's not surprising. After all, Arthur Ashe described her as the first black female to dominate a sport, yet she didn't get the recognition outside the black tennis community. Only now is the sporting world waking up to the lost champion of the segregated era.
Chris Bowers, and our thanks also go to the organizers of the recent Wimbledon Tennis History Conference, at which Chris was able to speak to Ashley Brown and Pamela Grundy. Next time, we bring the struggle for black players into the present with a look at how the legacy of Arthur Ashe is being kept alive. And we talk with Brian Shelton about the issues he faced as a black player in the 1980s and 90s and how things are different for his son Ben as he establishes himself among today's top male players. The Tennis Worthy podcast is brought to you by the International Tennis Hall of Fame. For more in the Tennis Worthy series, go to tennisfame.com/podcast and choose from a wide selection of interviews and discussions involving the great names of tennis. I'm Patrick McEnroe. Please join us next time as well. Meanwhile, thanks for your interest in the history of our sport.